Where is podcast? Precious wants it, wants it. Robertson needs to play the link now.
Well, if you didn't know, the second Hobbit film came out
on Friday.
Friday
in the UK. It's probably been out in the US for months or something. But
Cotter, how was it?
I have to say, I was really looking forward to the first one. And after the first one, I was, you know, a little deflated. I would watch anything set in the Middle-earth universe. If they made the Silmarillion, if they spun out Unfinished Tales into like 20 films, I would go and see every single one of them. I love the place. So this time, I went into it with a bit more of a realistic, I'll just go and see what happens. And, I wasn't disappointed, let's put it that way. I thought the bit with the fire and the Benedict Cumberbatch and the whoa was just really good.
Yeah, that's the bit I'm looking forward to.
Because you haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet. Yeah. No, I've got kids, so it's not quite as easy.
It's a 12A though, so but I think they're still a bit young.
They liked the first one, but we had to stop it halfway through when that sort of, is he a goblin? An orc, that white guy with the hook thing.
Azog.
It's a bit gruesome.
Yeah. Anyway, on to our podcast this week.
Yeah.
With the Religious Studies Project.
So, yeah, talking about otherworldly and magical things, welcome to the first of a two-part series on the paranormal and religious studies, curated and recorded for us by our friend Jack Hunter of the Paranthropology Journal. That's paranthropology.co.uk. You can read all of the issues for free there. It's some great stuff. This was recorded at a recent conference at the Esalen Institute, invitation only, very private, 15 scholars there. So it's very exciting to be able to present this. This first one addresses the question, what is the importance of the paranormal for religious studies? But even more, why has the paranormal been ignored by religious studies for so long?
But the paranormal's been... I don't think intentionally, but certainly erased in the history of religions as well. And I think the simple answer is that it's so problematic to the materialism that underlies the field. I mean, the reigning methodologies now are contextualism, constructivism, historicism, Marxism, and now Cogsci. And all of those methods really work through a kind of materialist assumption about how the world works. And the paranormal appears to seriously violate those assumptions. And so I think people don't, again, I don't think there's no conspiracy here. I think folks simply don't ask those questions or don't pursue those topics because they won't get published, they won't get jobs, they won't get promoted, or they're just... they make them nervous, you know, because of they're deep, deep metaphysical conflicts, I think, underneath all of this.
Yeah. And what is it about the paranormal that's sort of so important in the study of religions? What can it tell us about religion?
Well, pretty much everything. I mean, this is what's so odd about it. Once you get into the literature on the paranormal, you realize that it appears to be driving everything from what we call magic to what we call myth and folklore and ritual and belief in the soul, belief in an afterlife. I mean, it sort of runs the whole gamut almost of themes or topics of the study of religion. I'm not sure what it's not connected to. I think that's why it's so important. And not that it would solve everything if we suddenly started looking at it, but I think it would really enrich the fields. You know, I mentor PhD students. That's my day job, as it were. And we get a lot of young intellectuals coming to Rice who want to study these sorts of things. I mean, in some ways, that's how we frame a major part of our program. But what I tell all of them is you have to learn to take your passion, you know, what really turns you on, as it were, And you have to embed that in a field and a topic that the job market and the fairly conservative boxes of the academy will recognize. You can't just do the paranormal. You can't just do ghosts or psychical research or whatever it is. You have to embed it in a larger set of questions or projects that the field understands and accepts. And I don't think that's just a matter of jumping through a hoop or hiding or being in the closet. I think the field has very good reasons for demanding that kind of cultural knowledge or that kind of linguistic training or that kind of theoretical understanding. I think those are, if you want to play the game, if you want in the club, you got to pay the dues. Mm. But once you're in the club, once you have a job or on the other side of the dissertation, and you feel comfortable and safe enough, absolutely, you know, say whatever it is you want to say, but be smart about it. Be professionally smart. Don't be naive.
In religious studies, I think that we've gotten stuck in definitions of religion, and even though we argue a lot about what is religion, we don't look at the things that wind up under the other headings like magical or paranormal or occult or et cetera. And by getting stuck in these categories, we don't go underneath to look at the phenomena that may actually in their form look pretty similar. I mean, it's kind of amazing how similar phenomena wind up being studied under all these headings without people then realizing that they're studying things that interconnect so much.
Yeah.
I encourage people to, young scholars, graduate students in particular, to do two things at once, which is pursue the questions that they're most interested in, and at the same time, have an eagle eye on the job market and the kinds of job descriptions that are out there, and find a way to fit the questions that most interest them into some kind of recognizable field of study where there's jobs, if at all possible. Yeah. I think that there's a lot of avenues. I mean, there's a lot of data sources for these kinds of questions. And so the key, at least in religious studies, oftentimes is drawing your data from a field where you can have general expertise and teach those kind of intro courses same time that you're pursuing your research in whatever directions it takes you.
Why is the study of anomalous experiences important in the study of religions generally?
I just think that people have them. They're powerful. They're often transformative. They are striking to people precisely because they are not normal, so-called. And I think trying to understand them rather than trying to dismiss them is really, really central. I mean, you can take different ontological stances towards the experience, but that's quite different from the question of whether it's important to understand the experience.
And why do you think that they've been dismissed for so long in mainstream academia?
Well, I think often people who've tried to understand them have had a strong ontological commitment. So, you know, the Society for Psychical Research has, you know, a ton of really interesting data. But often the primary goal of that group was to prove that the experience was veridical. People really were talking to the dead. If you put the ontology to the side and you just say, what are people experiencing it? How do we understand the shape of that experience? That's a very different kind of question.
I don't think it has really with anthropology. It's the terminology. I mean, when I was doing my fieldwork in Cameroon, you had the Christian missionaries who were obviously living a supernaturalist life in the sense that they were religiously motivated, cultivated an attitude in which they tried to generate the presence of Jesus amongst them. That's the kind of the core way of being and of missionizing, not through sort of teaching or good works as such, although those also took place, but through generating mutual love, the presence of Jesus amongst them, So the idea was that it's Jesus himself who communicates. And that is a pretty, you know, you could, I don't know, call it paranormal, but it's a supernatural way of living, trying to live with more than just daily material existence. And then for the Bangwa as well, there was far more to life, always far more to life than just earning your living and learning a skill and a trade. And it's very, I found it very easy to understand, to get inside a world in which you have to make offerings, or you choose to make offerings to nature spirits when you cross a river, to compound gods when you want to ask their advice on something, or because you owe an obligation, to respect your ancestors. And then there are all the, what used to be called, and they sometimes still call them pidgin, the sort of the fetishes and the jujus, all the sort of power objects that you use, which mark the paths, which protect you against storms, which protect your crops. So I was living in a completely supernaturalist kind of world, which was not separated from the material in any way, but was just part of everyday life. Mm-hmm. I would never have thought of using the word paranormal. And I can't say that I saw or experienced anything that I would think of as particularly paranormal, but I was certainly immersed in a world in which ancestors and spirits, the presence of Jesus, God, Mary, whatever, you know, all these different terms, there was a world of different powers and energies and forces, which I was very aware of, and actually found quite, you know, both fascinating and quite congenial. It perhaps suited my own way of looking at the world anyway.
Yeah.
Just giving it a different language and framework.
So do you think that the term paranormal has got any kind of, you know, practical use at all?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it has a history within parapsychology and the Western occult tradition. I mean, we've got to use language. And so if you jettison one term, you've got to invent another. And the problems associated with the term paranormal, well, the main criticism is that well, these things occur, there's nothing that isn't normal about them. But we've still got to find another term then to talk about what we mean. And we can say things which don't fit mainstream materialist science, or we can talk about anomalous or extraordinary phenomena. But the problems, you know, exactly the same problems really, whatever term you have. So although it's fair enough to discuss it and to try and see the pros and cons of each term, there's not much point in jettisoning a term unless somebody comes up with something which is substantially better to try and say what you want to say.
Yeah.
I think mainstream academia is based on, I mean, it's a model based on reason and rationality, and which goes, you know, it has deep, deep roots. And those roots have become institutionalized over a long period of time. And it's been enforced for such a long time that anything that challenges the fundamentals of reason and rationality or brings them into question is seen as crazy or inadmissible or bizarre. And that's such a structure of the academic world that it's very difficult to do work or publish things that call into question any of those notions. But for me, the most important aspect of doing anthropology of religion is just for that reason, that you uncover things that do, in fact, challenge your assumptions about how the world works, the materialist assumptions of the world. And it's a struggle to try to understand what to do with that, you know. A lot of people in parapsychology, I guess, they adapt the scientific modality to try to prove the existence or the non-existence of this paranormal phenomena. For me, that's not such an interesting question. What's interesting about paranormality for me is what it has demonstrated to me is about how I should move forward on my own path. So all the paranormal experiences that I've had with spirit possession and sorcery have compelled me to investigate areas of research that I would have never dreamed of doing. One is the anthropology of the senses, which are very important in terms of tuning your senses into paranormal universe. Another has to do with the choices I make as a writer.
and which means that, you know, the way that writing is structured is based, it's called plain style, is based on this sort of materialist, rationalist orientation to the world, where you write in sort of as plain a way, without any elaboration, just the facts. And this is a mirror of a sort of objective, you know, it's a measure of objectivity, let's say. And so I decided early on that I could not, you know, the experiences I've had did not lend themselves to that kind of writing, or if I did write that way, I could do so, but I didn't feel good about it. I didn't feel like it was being faithful to the material that I had encountered. So so it's the paranormal, in a sense, has shaped the way that I approach my research, but it's also shaped the way that I represent that research in texts. Well, I think the most important thing is to be open to the world. What I like is be open to the world, so that if you close yourself off from the world, or you have a rigid orientation to the world, it's going to limit your perception of the world. It's going to limit your appreciation of the world, and it will close the door to you know, these other realms of experience that are probably out there. At least in my experience, they are. So, being open to the world, and if you're open to the world, then you write texts or produce films that are also open to the world, that leave open the possibility, and you write a text in such a way that it will be read 10, 20, 30 years from now. If it's couched in, you know, the sort of jargon and the theoretical orientation of today, it may be relevant today, but then these things come and go. So just that being open, letting the world enter you, which is makes you vulnerable, but that's a kind of fundamental philosophical orientation. The other thing is to try to write text as plainly as possible that connect with people, and so that your intention as a writer is almost never realized in the read. You know, you have no control over how a reader is going to subjectively read what you're writing, but to write simply and powerfully and evocatively, so that the reader can connect with you and take something from that. You know, take something that have a new question or a new feeling, a new thought.
My bias is to not think about religion and think about spirituality, and to think of religion as like a social construct that's based on experiences. And I think that for the most part, anything that we think of as spiritual has a kind of paranormal connotation. But organized religion has tended to control it. So even like the Catholic Church, which accepts a lot of paranormal things, there has to be a committee to decide if it actually happened. And in modern Protestantism, there's very little acceptance of the paranormal. The experiential basis that religion is founded on is really paranormal spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. And that's a universal. Yeah. Seems like a no-brainer to me, but there are lots of developments and embellishments of religion that have very little to do with the paranormal, such as getting organized to have a crusade and kill people. That's not my idea. We were just talking about this at lunch and despairing for not only studies of the paranormal, but all kinds of things in academia where the job market is not very rosy. And somebody was saying that I agreed with that you need to think of a lot of different skills that you can combine so that you always have a way of studying what you really would like to within the context of something else. So, for example, there are a lot of medical fields for which things about the paranormal could be very important, such as near-death experiences or takeaway experiences of people who are about to die, so that you could go into a number of medical fields for which this would be something you could use. And, of course, all kinds of studies of religion or, I don't know, probably there's no field where you couldn't make some connection. For example, studies of mass media and popular culture. Jeff Kripal's a good example of talking about the paranormal in connection with superheroes. But it's kind of difficult to think of any area in which you couldn't make some kind of application. You just go for what you love and imagine that you have to figure out a way to bracket or legitimize the study, and then you can just do whatever you want, and at least in the background. So, for example, there are a lot of medical practitioners, a lot of doctors in the United States who would never tell you on the surface that they have healing powers, but they do.
Yeah, and why do you think that is? Why don't they talk about
it? They don't talk about it because that would kick them out of the serious academy.
Yeah.
I think that, first of all, you're right. Mainstream academia has neglected parapsychological topics, with many, many exceptions, by the way. And the reason probably being that research in this field does not advance the career of mainstream scientists. Because it does not advance their career, they stay away from it. Also, it does not attract significant research money, because research foundations, to enhance their own prestige and to encourage more money being donated to them, tend to give money to safe topics. Right now, the safe topic in psychology is work in the neurosciences, and they are getting a great deal of money. This is really the year of the brain, according to President Obama. And the research that's coming in goes to very, very important, but also very, very mainstream topics. I think that if history had taken a different turn, and if parapsychological topics had really been embedded in scientific investigation from the beginning, we wouldn't be having the dearth of money and interest in mainstream psychology that we have right now. It's often said that parapsychological topics are a threat to the worldview of mainstream science. Well, that's a matter of opinion. I personally don't think that it is a threat. I think that mainstream science can accommodate new findings more easily than most people suspect. I think the main threat is to the prestige and the income of people in mainstream science.
Okay. So what do you think, what can parapsychology contribute to the disciplines like religious studies and anthropology?
I think that parapsychology can contribute a great deal in terms of research methods. There are many research methods, both qualitative and quantitative, both experimental and non-experimental, that can be utilized to study anomalous experiences and to do some sort of rigorous investigation that can find its way into peer refereed journals. Now, you ask what parapsychology can contribute to religious studies. That's pretty far down the list in terms of contributions. I think parapsychology can contribute much more to anthropology, to psychology, to sociology, and to other social and behavioral sciences. I really don't see that it can contribute very much to religious studies, because religion is a world apart from science. And parapsychology, despite what a lot of its opponents say, is really not motivated by religious motives. Some of the leading parapsychologists in the field are agnostics. Others, like myself, are very much disposed towards Unitarian church doctrines and even Buddhism and other religious and spiritual areas that are pretty far from mainstream American religious interests. But I suppose that there are some anomalous phenomena that are closely associated with religious studies, such as near-death experience,
such as, oh, the body experience, which are not really a part of mainstream parapsychology, unless they have some component that borders on psychokinesis, precognition, clairvoyance, and telepathy. Most of them do not, and so they're not really a part of mainstream parapsychology, but parapsychologists contributed research frameworks and research strategies that could be used to study them. I would suppose that the main overlap would be in the field of survival studies, such as reincarnation, past life studies, etc. And there again, it's parapsychologists who have contributed a great deal to the rigorous study of past life reports, mainly Ian Stevenson and his work, and that certainly is important, not in mainstream Christianity or Judaism, but in some of the Eastern religions and philosophies, and certainly in some of the indigenous religions. In Native American religions, before the European invasion, most of the tribes had some sort of concept of the soul and of past lives.
Well, they've been neglected because of the problem of the way that modernity is constructed. And Max Weber sums it up very, very accurately, I would say, with his concept of the disenchantment of the world. Although Weber thought, and I think throughout the 20th century, most scholars thought that that disenchantment ran deep, that it was the consciousness of modern people that was disenchanted. And that comes out of an odd collaboration of Enlightenment skepticism and post-Reformation theology, both the conservative and the liberal track in theology, so that even modern religion is disenchanted, along with the notions of science being in conflict with spiritual ideas, which is historically and philosophically inaccurate. But that created, particularly as the cultural authority of science and scholarship really took over in the modern world at the end of the 19th century with the development of the modern university system. And cultural authority, by that I mean the authority, the quality that allows people to make judgments about the world and be accepted without argument by ordinary people, which is, ironically and interestingly, a product of the late 19th century, at the discovery that the naked senses don't tell you what you need to know about the world. So microscopy and telescopes, and then spectroscopy, and then the developments in science and physics, and even in psychoanalysis added to this in a quasi-scientific kind of way, that people couldn't tell even about their own, the meaning of their own experience on their own, that they needed expert guidance, they needed the people who had learned these new ways of seeing in a non-naive, modern fashion. And that part of the problem, I think, with that, Jack, turned out to be what's kind of obvious in retrospect, that if the basis of that authority gets out of touch with what the ordinary person in the community can understand, then they become self-policing communities. So who can tell you who's a real physicist? Well, only some physicists. Mm-hmm. Who can tell you who really understands the mind? Only a person with advanced degrees in psychiatry and psychology. So the community loses its access. And with authority, by authority I mean accepting without reason. Well, cultural authority is a shortcut to where argument and reason would lead. And we need those shortcuts, because if everybody had to have proof of everything they were going to accept, we would never get anything done. But it also means you have to be able to trust authority on that. And so at any rate, when you lose the ability to even understand the arguments, you sort of give up. Well, I don't have to understand this, but things are working. We're getting the steam engine. We're getting antibiotics. We're getting electricity. We have the telephone. Technology is paying off. There's a great conflation of technology and science. And up until, I would say post-Second World War into the latter half of the 20th century, you reach a point where the authority, the cultural authority of science, has overreached, particularly, well, for myself, you notice it in medicine, where, for example, physicians, a simple example would be physicians making judgments about cost-benefit analysis of treatments. Well, part of the cost and part of the benefit is quality of life. How much pain are you willing to endure? How much is 6 more months of life worth? Those are actually not part of anything that physicians have expertise in. Those are things that only the patient knows. But increasingly, the patients were, were being given judgments about that that were disjunctive with their own experience and their own desires. So you get a growing pushback. At the same time that you have disillusionment with medical authority, and that's the point at which informed consent becomes big for exactly this reason, because you have you're losing trust in that medical overreach of authority. At the same time, you have the development of the sort of post-colonial wars with Vietnam, in particular for the U.S., and the authority of the government. The authority of your leader becomes questionable because you've been told things on authority that you afterwards find out there were not good reasons, there were not good arguments for it. And so there's at the same time that postmodernism also, probably for similar reasons, starts to challenge the grand narrative. So in a way, the end of the 20th century is a Edie talks about self-organizing. This is a self-disorganizing process of modernity because of the way in which it had become hypertrophied in terms of authority. So the sources of it are ideological, political, theological. They had to do with the competition for authority between science and the medieval church, and it was necessary sort of growing pains, but then it became bloated, I would say, and began to... you lose, with the development of these things in modernity, you lose respect for life experience as a source of authority, and only technical expertise has authority. Well, that's where the overreach comes in. It turns out that life experience has a lot to offer, particularly when major experiences in life have been left out of the scientific account and scientific investigation. And as I used the example in my presentation the other day, this is not only true of spiritual experience, it's true of sexuality, it's true of race, it's true of community relations, it's true of all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so sort of I think in the latter part of the 20th century, we see a recapture of the importance of life experience, which for me is an emblem of the problem around life experience, is the difference between, in modernity, the elderly, and outside of modernity, the elders. We don't mean the same thing by the elderly as they mean by the elders.
Yeah.
And why would elders have authority is because in those societies, life experience is valued. That's both, I think, how we come to have pushed out everything beyond the material, which was clearly where the expert authority applied in the developments of modern science and scholarship, and also how we happen to be, in a revolutionary way, I think, recapturing.
Well, clearly the paranormal is quite important for religious studies.
One way or another, yes. Certainly pokes at a few of the difficulties of our field, I think.
So we've got
pokes a finger into the raw, bloody wound.
Oh, the sacred wound.
The sacred wound, indeed.
The discipline. We've got a second one of these coming up on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Normally we put out fantastically insightful responses, written responses, but this week we've got another podcast.
Yeah, we got so much material that we made 2 episodes for you. That's how good we are to you, the listener.
Mm-hmm. So generous.
Yeah, the second one is on the question of ontology. How far should we go in
accepting the ontological position of the paranormal? How should we engage with the ontology? Should how much should we accept what we're being told, and how much should we challenge it? And how should we deal with that as a discipline? A fairly big range of positions, many of which I don't agree with, but nonetheless, interestingly argued.
Excellent, because you know we don't like to censor.
Censor, and we have a fair position, but we don't have an agenda. I think we're quite happy to give voices to people we disagree with.
We choose what we feature, but in the sense we feature things that you know might be controversial, but that we still think people should hear.
2 years we've been on air now.
This is emotional.
But in those 2 years, never once have we removed something that somebody said because we disagreed with it.
Actually, that is true.
That is true. We've never done that. There are minor edits go on for the sake of clarity and very occasionally for timing, but we've never, once we've asked them the initial question, we've never changed answers. We've never asked the same question twice and then, you know, removed one of the answers, for instance.
Yeah. So, you know, we're about debate and...
No, we're not.
See what you did there. Sparking conversations and promoting a healthy discussion. We should probably close off here just now. Obviously, remember that we're supported by the BASR, who are fantastic. Check out our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, Google+, all our Amazon links.
You can support us with the Amazon links, especially at this time of the year with your last few Christmas presents. Yeah. Why not give us a percentage of that at no extra cost to yourself and help keep this podcast free?
It's quite significant. It's 5% of the sale.
Yeah.
That actually works out quite well.
We're looking at adding about 50% onto our funding this year just through people using the Amazon links. So thank you very much, but keep doing it.
Next week, well, we've got our bonus podcast
on Wednesday,
which we'll do a very brief intro and outro to, but next week it's the Christmas special.
It's the Christmas special, Nilpois, recorded live at the BASR/EASR/IAHR conference in Liverpool in September this year, in front of a live studio audience.
It's pretty awesome, and you might want to, between now and then, go back through the archive, just type in Christmas in the search bar on the RSP site and maybe have a listen to exactly 60 seconds or only 60 seconds.
Yeah.
Which were a Christmas
and we're not
special.
It's not normatively a Christmas special. I mean, it could be a Hanukkah special or Festivus special or whatever atheists do. I don't know, crying by yourself in a room.
It's to mark the fact that we're taking a few weeks off.
Yeah.
Well-earned weeks off.
It's a reward for the BASR for supporting us. It's a reward for us because it's a lot of fun. And it's a reward for you, the listeners. You don't have to be serious this week.
Fantastic. Until then.
Thanks for listening.